In this part of Focus 580, we'll be returning to a topic that we certainly have discussed many times before on the show, and that's global climate change. We've tried to come at it from a variety of perspectives, mostly talking about what's going on a kind of a global scale. We have done some conversations about what climate change means for the Midwest. In this part of Focus, we'll be concentrating on a different part of the United States, a part that's long way away from here where we live, but where the effects of climate change and warming, at least in the last couple of decades, have been pronounced, and more so, certainly, than in this part of the country. And what we're talking about is Alaska, the Arctic, very specifically. And our guest for the show is Charles Wolforth. He's a journalist who makes his home in Anchorage, and he's the author of a recently published book that's titled The Whale and the Supercomputer on the Northern Front of Climate Change. It's published by North Point Press. And what the book tries to do is take a look at climate change in this part of the world and what it means for the people who live there and have lived there for a long time, making their living often off the land. And also another group of individuals, and that's the scientists who have come there to try to apply the most modern science and high tech to studying this issue. How it is that these two groups of people kind of observe one another and the things that perhaps each manages to learn from the other. So you can see in the title kind of the idea of the sometimes clash between nature and science. And people who specialize in living both of those ways. It's an interesting book, both for the portrait it paints of the scientists who are doing this work and also for the picture that it paints of Native people there and how they live their lives. So the book is out there in the bookstore if you're interested in taking a look at it. Our guest, Charles Wolforth, began his writing career at a weekly newspaper in an Alaskan fishing village and then developed his writing, doing freelance travel guides and articles for The New Republic, for Outside, other magazines. He's joining us this morning by telephone as we talk. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, folks. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, your questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so that we can get in as many as possible. Mr. Wolforth, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. So how long have you lived in Alaska?
Well, pretty much all my life, since I was 3 years old, which just about makes me a lifelong Alaskan, I think.
Almost a native.
Yes.
Tell me about the place that you live.
Well, I live in Anchorage, which is on the southern coast in the what we call South Central Alaska, on the Gulf of Alaska, and it's a beautiful place to live. You know, we can ski right from our house and cross country ski, and we've got great biking and boating here, and I just love it here, and I would really never live anywhere else.
Let's talk specifically about what's been happening with the temperatures there over the last few decades. I think one of the things that we seem to know with a fair amount of certainty is that the average global temperature over the last century, relatively speaking, that's the period we have good records, over the last 100 years, average global temperature has gone up by about 1 degree Fahrenheit. And that we also know that some of the warmest years have occurred recently, so in terms of global averages. But what you see if you take a look at the area where you live is that, and I think this is something that scientists actually did predict, that the warming there has been warming, but it has been even more significant than that. It's been a lot more than just 1 degree over 100 years. It's been several degrees over the last couple of decades.
That's right. And if you take the wintertime temperature in interior Alaska, that's plus 7 degrees over the last couple of decades from the long-term average. And there are different amounts of warming in different parts of Alaska. But in general, it's quite dramatic, and those averages have been calculated a couple of years ago. We've had a series of extremely warm winters and summers since then, so it's a continuing trend. And these are temperature increases which are sufficient to cause pretty dramatic changes in the ecology. You know, it really doesn't take a huge temperature change to change the way a forest looks, because, for example, in our area of Alaska, there are beetles that attack spruce trees. That they just needed it a couple of degrees warmer in the springtime to just take off and become extremely aggressive. Beetles that really hadn't been much noticed before, and that happened in the 1980s. And that temperature threshold was reached at that point, and it's never gone back down again. And so we had a 4 million acre die-off of spruce trees in our part of the state, which was the largest die-off of trees anywhere in the country ever. So it's something that, you know, 7 degrees might not sound like much on a particular day, but when it's an average, it has a profound effect on what the place is like.
Mm-hmm. Well, if there's one thing that I imagine people would associate with Alaska, it would be snow. And I know that you had talked to some people that were studying snowfall and snow cover. Has that been affected? And has the duration of the snow cover, you know, that is when it first starts in the fall and when you get your melt in the spring, has that changed?
Yes, dramatically. And it's changed all over Alaska. The farther north you go, the more dramatic that effect comes. But, you know, the reason I first got interested in writing about this subject was that I noticed in my home here in Anchorage that the winters were shorter and warmer, and more frequently we lost our snow, which when I was a child was unheard of. And I mentioned in the book, when I was a kid, you always used to have to wear heavy snowsuits over our Halloween costumes when we went trick-or-treating, because we were usually, you know, wading through snow. And now that's not the case anymore. And in fact, the last several years, my kids haven't had to wear any kind of coat. They could just wear their costume. So I looked around and I saw that something is changing. You know, we're losing our skiing earlier in the year. Our sled dog races are being canceled more frequently, where previously they were never canceled. What's going on? And started talking to scientists about what they were studying, and found out, well, yes, indeed, this was a predicted aspect of climate change, that it would hit the north first, and that it was a matter of very intense scientific study up here.
Hmm. So why is it that the effect is more pronounced in the northern latitudes than it is, say, where we live here in the central part of the United States?
Well, it's something that is one of those neat things. It's not that hard to understand, but you'd never really think of it until someone explains it to you. The snow and ice is, of course, white, and that means it reflects the sun back up into the sky. If you think about just how much a darker thing heats up in the sun, that's sort of the effect that I'm talking about. So if you've got the sun heating snow, it reflects about 80% plus of that energy back into the sky, and then, you know, back into space. So that heat never gets to the ground to warm up the earth. If you've got open water, that's more than 90% of the light that hits it is absorbed by the earth. On, say, ground, this, you know, regular vegetated ground, it's about 80% is absorbed. Only 20% is reflected. So as the snow melts and you have less snow on the ground, you have an increasing amount of the ground which is absorbing larger amounts of energy from the sun. And, you know, in most parts of the world, that the winter isn't that long, and the amount of snow on the ground isn't that great, so this isn't such a dramatic effect. But up here, the snow, you know, at least formerly, was on the ground most of the year. As that melts back, because of the climate is warming, it causes the earth to absorb more energy from the sun for a longer period of the year, and that, in turn, causes the snow to melt back further. So it's what's called a feedback loop. As the climate has started to change, that's caused this intensification or amplification of the change in the Arctic regions, which makes it warm faster here and also makes it very important for the rest of the world what happens here, because it's tending to warm up the whole world. It just, you know, this it's called the albedo effect. Albedo just means whiteness or reflectiveness. And scientists believe in the past this effect has really turned the whole Earth into a snowball many millions of years ago. In other words, as there's more snow covering more of the Earth, it cools quickly in a cascade runaway effect. And when the snow melts, it tends to accelerate it in a feedback loop effect.
Mm-hmm. That gets to the question that I'm sure that is on a lot of people's minds, and that is, scientists have various ways to look back into the past and to try to make some assessment of what climate of the Earth was, not just 100 years ago, but thousands, if not more years ago, long, long time ago. And what we see is there are periods where there are wide swings in the temperature. There are periods when it's hot, warmer. There are periods when it's cold, colder. We have these swings. And I think the question a lot of people have when you're looking at the kind of changes in temperature that we have seen over the last century is, well, is that just part of a natural cycle that the planet goes through and that there are going to be colder times and there are going to be warmer times? Or is what we have seen here something different from what we've seen before? And then the big question is that the result of human activity, the warming that we have seen?
Right. Well, there's no doubt in my mind that there are natural variations and swings, cycles in temperature upward and downward, and it's very possible that part of the warming we're seeing is influenced by that. But let me give you the case for why there's a high probability that it's in part human-caused or mainly human-caused. First of all, when we look into the past, for the last 400,000 years ago, we're able to see not only what the temperature was like, but also how much carbon dioxide was in the atmosphere. And carbon dioxide is the main greenhouse gas that we emit from burning fossil fuels that causes the greenhouse effect, or the warming that is the problem we're talking about. And the way we're able to know this is because of drilling into ice cores in Antarctica and Greenland and even here in Alaska and pulling bubbles out from ice that's been frozen for hundreds of thousands of years, and then analyzing the gas in those bubbles, or the atmosphere as it was back in the past. For the last 400,000 years, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was between 180 and 280 parts per million. Since we started burning fossil fuels, we've increased that number from 280 to about 380 parts per million now. So we've made an enormous increase in the quantity of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere because of our burning of fossil fuels. Now, during the 400,000 years that I'm talking about, Earth went through a series of ice ages where ice covered most of North America at times and it melted way back at other times. Those were in correlation or were timed with the increases and decreases in carbon dioxide. So that amount of change in the carbon dioxide was capable of changing the climate by that degree. So that's something that tells us, yes, we have an unprecedented increase in carbon dioxide during our industrial period, and yes, we know that changes in carbon dioxide cause enormous changes in the climate. Now, the other strand of evidence that comes from this paleoclimate or ancient climate study is that these changes in temperature over the past appear to have been fairly gradual and smooth. In other words, you had a sort of a sine curve going up and down that was not drastic. Well, the changes in temperature we're seeing in the last 50 years are not anything but smooth. It's a sharp upward jerk, and that's really not consistent with the sort of the natural cycle. So if you put all this evidence together, to me, it seems very improbable that you could say that, well, yeah, we put this huge amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but no, that's not having any effect. What we don't know is how much we're causing and how much nature is causing, but it would seem to me that probably we're causing most of it.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Charles Woolforth. He's a journalist. He makes his home in Anchorage, Alaska, and has written for a number of publications. He's done travel writing for people who are interested in going to Alaska. He's also written articles for New Republic, Outside, other magazines. His book that deals with specifically with the effects of climate change on the Arctic is titled The Whale and the Supercomputer on the Northern Front of Climate Change, and the book is published by North Point Press. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk a little bit about the indigenous people who they and their forebears have been living there for a long, long time. And talk a little bit about what the climate changes that we've talked about mean for them and the way that they live their lives.
Well, really didn't know what a big thing was happening for these people until I started researching the book, and then I found out that they were by far the most interesting part of it. And one, I mean, there's several reasons for that, but one is that these people are going through what I expect everyone on Earth will be going through perhaps in a few decades. They are having to adapt, making major changes in their lifestyle because of climate change. And in a sense, they're the forerunners of the rest of the human race in that respect. And the reason for that is both we've discussed about how it's warming so much more there, and also they're living in a place where the land and sea are really solid only when it's below freezing. They use the sea ice as other people use the land. They hunt on it and they travel on it, and then the land is kind of mushy on top and then frozen underneath, and it's easy to travel on only when it's frozen. And so when the temperature gets too high, it really creates wreaks havoc on their world. The main part of their lifestyle is based on hunting bowhead whales, and the bowhead is a population that migrates past northern Alaska up into the Arctic north of Canada. And I hasten to add, it's a healthy population, which is increasing, and the bowhead hunt by the Eskimos is regulated by the International Whaling Commission, and that is their hunt is supported by Greenpeace and all the other environmental organizations, because they've been at it for over 1,000 years, and it is the fundamental and most important central part of their culture, socially, spiritually, and it's also very important in the food that they eat. And so I went whale hunting with them several times, and I observed the amazing amount of danger that they're facing because of the ice becoming less stable and less secure, and it's an extraordinary adventure that they are facing in trying to adapt to that.
Yeah. That's part of the story that I think is, I think both parts of the stories are interesting. I mean, when you learn about the scientists and their work, but I think that perhaps the story of how the native people there live is even more compelling. Maybe it's just because it is so different from the life that I'm sure almost everybody who would read the book would live. But it might be interesting to talk a little bit about whale hunting and the way that they do it, because it's perhaps not what people would imagine, that what they're doing is that they're going after these whales in relatively small boats, spearing them, and then what they literally have to do is haul the whale by human power, haul the whale out of the water onto the ice that's along the water, and then use that as the place where they can take it and cut it into pieces and make it handleable so that then everybody can get their share of meat and the stuff that you can use from the whale. And that also is one of the reasons why, if the ice is not stable, that can make this whole business so dangerous, because you rely on having a very solid platform to work on, and if it's not, it can be very dangerous. And there are stories in the book about people who were out doing various kinds of things, working on the ice when it broke off and started to float away, and they didn't even know it. They were apparently on a piece that was so big that they were just trying. They were going about doing what they were doing, and they didn't even know that they were floating off out into the water until someone came to rescue them. So maybe you could talk a little bit about about how it is they hunt whale.
Yes, well, they hunt the whale very much the same way that their forefathers learned to do it around 1000 or 1200 AD, and it involves building a skin boat, which is originally would have been made of driftwood, and now they would use lumber for a frame, and then it's got the skin of the ugruk, which is the bearded seal, covering it. And it might be about 14 or 15 feet long. and it's dragged to the ice edge, which could be 3 miles or even up to like 12 or 15 miles from shore on trails that have to be chipped out of the ice. And keep in mind, we're not talking about lake ice here. You know, the ice builds up into these huge pressure ridges, which are like little mountains, and the whalers will go out there with picks and smash through those to build a trail so they can get their equipment pulled behind a snow machine out to the ice edge. And then very quietly, and following the traditional rules, which call for humility and silence and harmony between the people, they'll wait to see a whale come along. Essentially, it's an ambush. They will build a blind of ice, and they'll all wear white. And when a whale is spotted, the whalers very quickly get into the skin boat and paddle after the whale. So they have to be, one reason they have to be stealthy is because they can't paddle as fast as the whale can swim. And then they have to put the boat basically right on the whale's back or within touching distance next to the whale. And these are whales that could be 50, 60, even 70 feet long and weigh more than a tractor trailer is fully loaded on the highway. And then they throw the harpoon into the whale and catch it. And traditionally, after the whale had tired, one of the men would climb onto the whale's back and walk on it and then plunge a lance down into a sensitive part of it. One of the last men who knew how to do that and who did it regularly died in an accident a few years ago as an old man. And now mostly other technologies used to kill the whale. That kills the whale a little bit faster. So then once the whale is dead, it's pulled to shore by many boats working together, and a rope is tied around the tail, and the entire community comes out and pulls the whale out of the water using block and tackle, which is just an amazing experience. I got to participate in this a few times, and I put some pictures of it on my website at whaleandsupercomputer.com. And this one particular whale I helped with, it took us about 6 hours of steady work by about 200 people to pull it out of the water onto the ice. It's very important to find a solid piece of ice because otherwise it'll break and the whale will fall back into the water. And then it took another 12 or 14 hours to cut that whale up into pieces that could be distributed to everyone in the community because they don't believe any one person can own a whale. After all the work of catching a whale, the food is all distributed freely. And it was just such an amazingly rewarding experience to be involved in a community that works together in that way for everyone's joint benefit. And also really interesting to see the whaling crew and the family of the captain who work, they put their entire year's work into doing this hunt, and then they have to work so hard to get the whale out of the water, and then they prepare the food, their share, and serve it to anyone who comes to their door. And I was with a family where the women were just finishing up, getting ready to serve. They prepared this food. They'd been working for maybe 48 hours straight without a break, and the food was already there, and they prayed, and tears were just streaming down their faces. And one of them turned to me and said, "This is the happiest day of her life," which just shows you the power of this whale in their culture, that, you know, to do all this work in order to give it away is the most wonderful day for them. So anyway, the hazard, of course, comes in the fact that you're out there on the sea ice, and the sea ice can break off and float into the ocean, or you can have a collision of different pieces of sea ice hitting each other. And because of the warming of the climate, the ice has become much less predictable. And as I was hunting with these crews, just frequently, every day, sometimes twice a day, there had to be a speedy escape because of danger of a break-off or of a collision. And then the day that I left, as you mentioned, the ice did break off all along the shore, and about 100 whalers floated out to sea and didn't know it until somebody tried to get back to the village and found out that there was a big crack of water behind them. It was impossible. And helicopters were brought in, and a very heroic rescue was effected, which included, you know, the helicopters having to find their way through the fog to where the people were on the ice, and then they couldn't land on the ice because the helicopter was too heavy, so they had to keep the rotors running while they gingerly touched down, and people got on the helicopter, and then they would take a cable and string it through the skis of the snow machines and sleds, so they would carry like a necklace of snow machines under the helicopter fly back to the beach, put everybody down, and then go out for another trip, and kept this going all night long until they had brought in, you know, all of these people safely, and then most of their equipment. Some of the equipment was lost into the ocean. And then just to tell you the importance of whaling to them, they were soon back out there again, going back to work, pursuing the whale again.
Yeah. It's interesting you talk in the book about the fact that now that there are large pieces of ice that are floating and that occasionally drift up and slam into the stationary ice, the ice there that's more up against the edge of the land,
mm-hmm.
and that there's a word for it. There's a special word for it.
Ivu.
That's what happens when one of these floating pieces comes up and slams into the other ice, and that it can be like an earthquake if you happen to be standing on the other part of the ice.
An earthquake dialed up to the 10th degree, because not only does ice shake, but one, you know, you have to think of the momentum of an ice flow that's many miles across hitting another one. It doesn't stop. It just breaks the ice and rides up over it, and, you know, the ice all starts to crumble and fall apart, and big, huge pieces. I mean, these things can be 50 feet high. I've seen pictures of them even higher than that. When the collision takes place and the ice breaks in all directions, so terribly dangerous. The climate change impact there is that formerly there would have been more of what's known as multi-year ice. This is these big icebergs that last all the way through the summer, and then they refreeze and they get even bigger. So they're enormous, heavy icebergs. And they made it for a safe sanctuary for the whalers because they were so large and they tended to get stuck on the bottom. Now there's not many of these multi-year ice flows appearing in northern Alaska, and so if there is an EVU, you don't have that protection, and you just have to make a really hasty escape to get away from where that could occur.
Yeah. It's really remarkable, and I'm now looking at some of the pictures here on the website, particularly this one photo where you can see kind of a panoramic view of a whale that has been killed, and it's now lying on the ice, lying on its side, and there are some people surrounding it. So you can also get a sense of the scale, just how big the whale is compared with the people, and against these vast vistas of snow and ice. It must be just a remarkable kind of experience.
Well, it was a very at first a very disorienting experience, and wonderfully, but also kind of weird, because there's no orienting yourself on the ice. You know, the shore looks exactly like the ice, basically. It's all white, and it's got this strange texture of pressure ridges and bumps. Everything is white, and there are polar bears wandering around that are very difficult to see. And then the other aspect is, of course, it's a midnight sun. You know, the sun is always up, so the sky looks the same pretty much all day, and then at that time of year, around midnight or 1 or 2 o'clock, the sun would drop low into the northern horizon and get these beautiful colors. But, yes, a very strange, for somebody who's from a place where we have green trees and grass and mountains, it was very strange and disorienting. But the people were so welcoming and so warm and took me into their culture and their families so easily and quickly that I really started to feel like that was where I was at home and that's where I belonged. And right after that, I had to go to the East Coast to do some more reporting on the book, and I ended up feeling much more alienated and out of place among freeways and buildings and all that. You know, it just started to seem like the sea ice and this beautiful natural area was so much more soothing and homelike, despite the polar bears.
Our guest is Charles Wolforth. He lives in Anchorage, Alaska, and has spent most of his life in Alaska. Began writing for a weekly paper in an Alaskan fishing village. Worked as a freelancer writing travel guides and articles for various publications, including The New Republic and Outside, other magazines. And he's written a book about climate change in the Arctic. It's titled The Whale and the Supercomputer on the Northern Front of Climate Change, and it's published by North Point Press. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just one more question that has to do with whaling and also the relationship sometimes a little bit uneasy between native people and scientists. And it concerns the numbers of whales. And you tell the story in the book about at what point people thought that these whales, the bowheads, they're right whales, were endangered, and scientists around the world really wanted to stop the hunting completely. And they had some idea about how many whales there were. And the native people had some idea about how many whales there were. They disagreed. And it turns out that eventually the native people were vindicated. It turned out that there were indeed more whales than the scientists thought. And based on that, they have allowed a certain amount of subsistence hunting. That is, the people are entitled to kill a certain number of whales. They've figured out how many is okay. But that says something about maybe how sometimes scientists don't always have the answer, and that it's important at least to draw on the experience of people in the place that you're studying.
Right. Well, you know, the scientists were doing their whale count in the way that they had done in other places. They would sit on the shore and watch the whales go by, and then they do a statistical calculation of how many whales there were. And the calculations told them that there were so few whales, just a few thousand, that extinction was already inevitable. In other words, even if you didn't hunt, the whales were going to go extinct. And the natives said, well, wait a minute. We know that there are more whales. We just know how many there are. And we know that they're swimming under the ice where you can't see them. And we know that they're going on a much wider band on their migration so that they're out of sight of where you're sitting. And so you're wrong, and we have a different number. And, of course, who did everyone believe? I mean, the scientists or these uneducated Eskimos. And after maybe millions of dollars of further research, it was found that the Eskimos were completely vindicated. Each thing that they had said turned out to be true. And there have been other examples of this in the Arctic disagreements between what the scientists said was the fact and what natives said was the fact. And what it's proved up for a lot of people is that you can, you know, if native people who live on the land in a place and have a tradition of knowing about that place and of gathering information as a community, really know it a lot better than scientists who come in and do a few measurements and try to answer a hypothesis in the style that Western science works. It's simply that the human mind is a very much more subtle and complex thing than we give it credit for, and it's able to see these patterns. And when you put many minds together who are very closely linked by a culture and a method of communication, they're able to process information in a way that's quite extraordinary. One scientist who lives in Barrow and has been up there in the Arctic for 25 years referred to it as the Inupiaq supercomputer. In other words, these Inupiaq people had the ability to process vast, vast amounts of environmental information and come up with statements about what was happening in this environment that were true, and yet nobody really understood exactly how they did it or where that information came from. And that forms one of the most interesting parts of the whole thing for me, is starting to understand what different ways we have of knowing the environment, you know, that there's more than one way that's valid.
Hmm. Well, so the bottom line here, the conclusion is here that the people who were living there knew about the warming before the scientists did, or at least the scientists came along, applied their methods and said, look, it's getting warmer. And the native people said, well, we could have told you that.
Right. That's one of the things you hear up there all the time, is that scientists come up here and spend all this money to prove things that we already know. I've heard that phrase said more than once. The warming is, it's a subtle thing in that, as we discussed earlier, how do you know it's a one-way trend or if it's something that's a cycle? There's been a recognition that there was warming for a long time, but what's hard for people to say is it one way or is it a cycle? And I think that they've pretty much come to the conclusion up there among the native people that it is unprecedented. In other words, there's nothing in their tradition, there's nothing their elders can tell about that looked like this. So that, and that suggests that it's a one-way thing. But they're very conservative and cautious about making these kinds of statements. So from the native point of view, there's definitely a drastic warming, a change in the environment and that it appears to be unprecedented, at the same time, there's a reluctance to accept that because it means such a huge change to their way of life.
We have a couple of people to talk with here who are listening. First up, caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Yes, go ahead. Line one, Urbana.
That's interesting. Could you discuss how technology is changing this? Like some news sources say, some people no longer use igloos, but they live in wooden houses and so on. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay.
Right. Well, the igloos were actually used in the Canadian Arctic. There are never igloos really used in the Alaskan Arctic. The people built sod houses that were dug into the ground, and then they would use driftwood or whalebone to put the roof on it and then put sod over the top. And in that way, they made very highly energy-efficient homes. And it was with the arrival of Protestant missionaries around the turn of the century, around the 1900s, 1800, 1900, that the missionaries, for whatever reason, wanted the people to live in houses that looked more like a normal American house made of wood. And so the sod houses were primarily abandoned at that time, about 100 years ago, and people moved into wooden homes, which really don't make nearly as much sense. They're much harder to heat in that Arctic environment. And there are many other aspects of technology that have changed. Change has been very quick. Of course, in the last 100 years, technology change has been very quick in our culture, too. You can fly on a 737 to Barrow, where this whaling is going on. The natives there own a large corporation, the largest in Alaska, which is in the oil business and various other businesses. They have excellent schools, and they have a bus service that drives around the village and picks people up. Some of the technology change that's taken place, whaling technology change has been much slower. They're still using the skin boat because nobody's ever invented anything that works better. It's just the perfect boat for operating on the ice because it's very light, very flexible, resistant to damage, quiet in the water. And even the Yankee whalers who came from New England to go up there and whale in the 1880s, roughly, built using these Umiak skin boats because they work so much better than their wooden boats. So there's a lot of conservatism in not changing some of that, but there's also aspects, as the climate changes, that folks have been forced to use more motorboats with outboard motors because it's much safer to cruise around in the water looking for a whale than to sit on the ice when it's the ice is so dangerous. And they're moving more towards whaling in the fall when the ice is not there, using large motorboats, because, again, the hazards are not as great with the ice being so unpredictable. Now they've got the hazard of bigger waves because there's less ice there in the fall, so they're going to bigger boats. And so technology is allowing them to continue their hunt, but in sort of a different form, in part, than traditionally it was.
All right, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Let's talk with someone else. The next person is in Decatur on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yes. Hello.
Yes.
I wondered if you could discuss the studies of a man named George DeVoeke, who has been studying a bird called the black guillemot up in the near what's the name of it?
Near Point Barrow, yeah.
Yeah, could you discuss that? He wrote an article about it in the New York Times Magazine back in January of 2002.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, DeVoeke is a fascinating guy. He was sent up to the Arctic, I believe, in the late 1970s when there was an oil research project going on to determine environmental impact of oil development. And while he was up there as a young graduate student, he found a population of these guillemots living on an island northeast of Barrow, which is just a small barrier island. It's only a few inches above the water, gravel, nothing grows there. And these guillemots would a bird that normally would be found much farther south, and it was a curiosity as to what they were doing there. And he made that into his research project, and he really made it into his life work as he went back there each year and banded these birds and studied them and studied how things were changing for them and watched their population grow and grow and grow through the years. Well, one of the things that we've learned about climate change is that nature responds to it much more sensitively than you would expect, and really turns out to be the best measurer of what's happening with climate change, because it kind of, you know, when you take temperature measurements with a thermometer, the temperature pops up and down from day to day, and it's really hard to figure out the trends. Well, nature doesn't have that difficulty, and if you see new species moving farther north, you know that the climate is changing, and we've seen that worldwide as the range of different species have moved farther north. Well, Devoki took on this particular colony of birds as his project, and went there year after year, lost his funding. You know, institutions have not been very interested in long-term study, so he just would take his vacation to this tiny island and sleep in a tent all summer in this frigid conditions counting these birds. And what he found was the numbers went up and up and up, and then they started to crash. He thinks because of the changes in the ice, the fact that they had to fly much farther to get to the food that they wanted. And now the latest thing that's happened, which has happened subsequent to the article you're talking about, is puffins are starting to show up on that island and drive out the guillemots.
What are showing up?
Puffins.
Oh, puffins.
Yeah.
Oh,
which is another bird that you would never, ever expect to see on the Arctic.
They're the same family, but...
They're also alcids. They're birds that live in the water, but normally they'd be found much farther south. So there appears to be sort of a change where perhaps that island became habitable for guillemots, and then the further change is it becomes habitable for puffins. But it's really, you know, these things are hard to draw a conclusion from, because the problem with Devoki's study is he's only studying one little island, you know, and you need to really have a much broader scale view. There's other people who have been studying the ocean floor and what's been happening there and have found really dramatic changes in terms of the organisms that live under the sea, and the fact that, you know, the ocean has been warming and climate trends have been changing, that's affected the productivity of different kinds of animals and species shift. And so there's a lot of other strands of evidence from the natural world of how this is taking place in the oceans.
I understand there's a couple of species of eiders that are found in Alaska, and their population has declined drastically in the last 20 years or so.
Yeah, and we could actually go on for quite some time about the species shifts. It's been quite something, and I spent some time with elders on Arctica, Alaska, and the inland areas who talk about complete changes in the species diversity and the different species of birds arriving and others disappearing. So, and also in the plant communities with big increases in certain kinds of shrubs. It's become much bushier up there as it's gotten warmer and as the ground has gotten warmer. So a lot of change in the natural world.
Are these all subjects that you discuss in your book?
A lot of it, yeah. I don't actually get into George Devoki's work in any depth because there was somebody else writing a book about him. But I got into a lot of it, especially about plant ecology and somewhat about wildlife.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We're down to the point here. We have maybe about 5 or 6 minutes. There is one other interesting, of the many interesting things in the book that I wanted to ask you about. And for people here, probably in this part of the United States, if they know anything about Alaska and environmental issues there, they have followed the long, long controversy about oil drilling on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Thing that we've been wrestling back and forth on this for probably a couple of decades now, in between people on the one hand who say we need to be energy independent, at least that is independent of imports of oil from elsewhere, so we ought to use whatever resources we have, and they say this is one that should be used. And on the other hand, we have environmentalists and other people who say that doesn't make any sense. They question how much oil is there to be had, and they say that they're concerned that there could be a lot of negative impacts on the environment in that area. What's interesting is that the native people, and you might expect something different, the native people are actually support oil production, and particularly in that area, in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And I would think that it probably would be the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, you know, it's and I've written about this in other forums too, because it is kind of a, seems like a paradox that they're being affected so drastically by climate change, and yet they support oil development. First, I would say, you know, they're not. I don't think they're hypocrites. They've strenuously opposed any oil development offshore because their main, their primary way of life is based on marine mammals. And the oil industry has not shown that it can clean up oil spills offshore. Therefore, they oppose any oil development offshore. Onshore, they support oil development, and it's really been the main economic support ever since the Prudhoe Bay oil field was discovered in 1969. And it's allowed them to have the schools and the helicopter rescue and everything else that they've got up there. Why do they support it when climate change is going on? Well, I there's a couple of strands to that. One is simply the sense that they're not the ones burning the oil. You know, they happen to live on top of it, and so naturally they would like to harvest that resource, and they view it as another resource like the resources that they hunt that brings them all the good things that allow them to live. And in a sense, turning to them and saying, hey, you shouldn't support oil development is a little bit like turning to some third world farmer and saying, you know, don't grow opium poppies when we don't seem to be able to restrain our consumption. So that's one strand of it. Another is just simply that it's people have a hard time connecting fuels and the way we live with what we're doing to the climate. And it's not, it's true all over the world. People are only just starting to gather that this is a major problem and that really is going to require some changes in our lifestyle and how we do things. And I think that's the same thing in the Arctic, that people realize even though the problem is so much more severe and pronounced, it takes a while before people translate into that into their own actions because, you know, for each of us as individuals, our actions seem so insignificant, and yet if we all take action together, it will have a significant impact. So I think those are the kind of the strands of it. But in a way, it goes back to their whole spiritual view of the environment. They view the environment as the source of everything, you know, the, all the good things that, that give us life. And their attitude towards oil has been similar. You know, when they got the ability to heat their houses with fuel, that was one of the greatest moments in their history, you know, that they no longer had to be cold. So oil is something they have a high regard for.
We're almost to the point where we're out of time. I guess the way to end is maybe as we've begun, we talked a little bit about what's going on in the Arctic, that it is seems to be leading a trend that we're seeing elsewhere, as had been predicted by scientists. That is, they said where there's going to be warming, it's going to be more pronounced there. For us who live in this part of the United States, what do you think that we have to learn by looking at what's happening in the Arctic?
Well, you know, there's an opportunity that you have that the Eskimos didn't, which is you can see it coming from a little bit farther off. Rather than having these changes thrust upon you, it's going to come a little bit more gradually in the temperate regions. It's probably not going to be like that movie that came out in the spring, which I saw recently, where everything happens overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly what the changes are going to be are difficult to predict. In some places, there will be a much drier climate. There will probably be more storms. In some places, it may be wetter and even colder if it affects world circulation patterns. So in terms of the adaptation, the thing that I thought was really interesting was that people are using new technology to adapt, in other words, deal with a world that's warmer and has different climate. And they're also having to have a little bit of humility. In other words, the recognition that if it's happening, you can't change it, and you may have to change your way of life. You may not be able to live right on the shore if you have bigger waves and faster erosion. You may have to move your town. You know, there may be things about our way of life that we can't keep the same. And that level of humility before nature, the recognition that nature is in charge and that we're along for the ride, is something that the Inupiaq have because they've experienced it through the millennia of their life in that very harsh environment. And it's something that we could learn with great benefit, I think.
Well, there we must stop. For people who would like to read more, and there is certainly much more, the book is The Whale and the Supercomputer by our guest Charles Wolforth. It's published by North Point Press. If you'd like to learn more about him and the book, there's a website, which is www.whaleandsupercomputer.com. So you do that, whale and supercomputer, all as one word, no spaces, and you'll get there. You can read some articles about him, see some pictures, and learn more about the book. And Mr. Wolforth, I want to say to you, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.